Twin Peaks. And on this version of Twin Peaks, we see some pretty amazing geometry, which of course is about a mile away. There's also regular geometry of things in the forefield. Now, they've JPEG'd the hell out of this image, meaning they've compressed it when they stored it on the hard drives at JPL for downloading from the web. But you can actually see that the JPEGing on this South Peak is not the same as the JPEGing on the North Peak, which of course is the one. This is not the super resolution view. Again, we're looking at that same kind of regular geometry. And Ron is preparing a second analysis of the Twin Peaks for posting on our website. He has now had a lot more time to think and reflect. And of course, I mean, look at all these symmetries here. See these little circles? And I mean, there's tons of stuff, debris, that is not. Look at the interesting symmetry of this, with, again, symmetry is a key non-geological manifestation. So Ron is going to be doing an update to his Twin Peak analysis. And in fact, this is pretty astonishing and should not exist. And this, of course, gets back to the scale question, because these things are the scale of the pyramids at Sidonia. Now remember, our model is that the Sidonia pyramids are not pyramids at all. They're really high-tech arcologies, architectural ecologies, enclosed supercondominiums, which whoever was colonizing Mars was using to live inside, with the atmosphere outside being inhospitable. With high technology, the 800-pound gorilla can live anywhere it wants, right? But the scale of this stuff is very different than the scale of this stuff, which brings to mind a very speculative notion. But since we're here to do this in part, what the heck? Gets back to your question, which is the crucial question. What happens if you colonize Mars from the big guy, the 4 to 5 Earth mass planet, that life somehow originates and evolves at that distance from the sun? Because with that planet in the solar system, the physics, the hyperdimensional physics, is different. The information transfer rate between dimensions in our model is greater. The sun is brighter. Earth and Venus and Mercury are inhospitable to anything but small creatures. And the real center of intelligent activity in the solar system would be in the asteroid belt, or where the big guy would have lived. Which means that life indigenously could have evolved at that distance from the sun. Now, this is what happens. Because the physics is dependent, again, on this Schuster relationship of angular momentum, if I blow a planet up and eject most of it beyond the solar system into the galaxy and have left only Mars wandering around in a isolated orbit now as a lone planet, or maybe with a little small moon orbiting it as the other moon from the big guy, which in Ben Flanders' model seems to be indicated, what has happened in that incredible shock of the catastrophe is that not only has the solar system lost a significant fraction of momentum, which means the sun will get dimmer. And we'll detail this in the next book. But if Mars now is suddenly bereft of its big parent, it means the hyperdimensional environment for Mars has suddenly shrunk as well. And to a first order in our model, the size of the biology on a planet is dependent on the hyperdimensional connection between this space and other so-called state spaces. In other words, it depends on the strength of the link. It's like an information signal. It's like, if this cable is too long, I can't communicate from the computer to the projector so you can see it on the screen. If I make the cable shorter, information travels more freely with less noise, therefore the signal is better and the picture is sharper and clearer and has less noise in it. In a similar metaphor, biology in this model is dependent both in its complexity and in its size on this relationship between dimensions. If the link is weak, the biology is small and pretty puny and not very diverse. If the link is strong, then the biology will be big, because gravity is inversely proportional to the transfer rate in the equations, and the complexity of life will be extremely broad. It's like signals. More bandwidth, more information, more diversity. Less bandwidth, less signal, less diversity. And the amplitude is the strength of the signal. That's where the size comes in. So in this model, dinosaurs lived prior to the breakup of the planet and were big because the physics was much bigger, gravity was less, because they're inversely related, and so you had the behemoths that you could not have Steven Spielberg do his number today. Michael Crichton is wrong. You can't grow a Tyrannosaurus rex to a four-story building. It would be maybe the size of a poodle if you clone it. And that's a prediction. So what is going on with Mars? Why do we have huge apparent artificial condominiums and little tiny tanks? Well, imagine the scenario if there is life on Mars, colonized, and there's a war. And when the planet is blown up, not by natural means, but through the incredible technology of the conflict, the physics plummets, it falls. And the evolution of life in the colonies goes from big guys who lived in this stuff to little guys in some incredible transition which we can only guess at until we get access to the real data, which is what they're busily gathering even as we speak up the hill at JPL while telling us the lander is dead and the battery is broken down and all that. How convenient. Now they don't have to make any more fake pictures. They can look at the real ones and not have to worry about us. So in this model, the size of the artifacts parallels our attempt to reconstruct the planetary history itself. It's a one-to-one match. Now, is it going to be accepted? Of course not. Not yet. But I will bet you dollars to Navy beans, that's a line from Star Trek, that the guys at JPL, when we put this together and put it on the web, are going to be avidly interested because it will be another confirmation that they don't know everything there is to know about physics and biology. And it will explain lots of interesting stuff. And the way we're playing the game is I'm giving this freely out there and our team. And let them use it. At some point, we have to bring these two fractured halves of our society back together. The elitists who think they know everything and the rest of us who they don't think count for anything. And one way to do this is to show them that we too can figure things out. And maybe we figured out a few things that they haven't thought of. Because it is not going to be peaceful and tranquil on planet Earth if this physics is correct. The future projections a la Art and his quickening, or a la our hyperdimensional model, or a la El Nino, or strange volcanoes that suddenly erupt overnight, is projecting that in the years to come, this physics is going to bite us in the delicate parts of our anatomy. And unless we are prepared to intervene with the toys of the military-industrial complex, which I think they have developed and don't understand the full potential of their use, because they're playing G.I. Joe, we are all in terrible trouble. That's the bad news. The good news is we can creatively and successfully intervene. This is a physics, literally, that blows up planets. Now, I'm not recommending that we give a kit to every kid for under the Christmas tree. But what we can do is to use this knowledge to intervene and ameliorate the planetary processes on a scale that is inconceivable to most of mainstream science. And I don't have to prove any of this because they're out there looking at the stuff themselves. All we have to do is to bring a constituency that is smart enough to know what's going on, together with the guys who are keeping what is going on a secret, and change will come. Because they don't have a death wish. They're not malevolent evil monsters. They have families and children and grandmothers and picket fences and car payments and all that. They just are moving in the wrong direction, which is what elitists do from time to time. That's why Thomas Jefferson said that every 20 years, a little revolution might be useful. Anyway. Yes. Well, because we have the Viking orbital shots, and when the Viking orbital shots were taken, they were not mucking around. They didn't know enough to muck around. I mean, this is why I completely disagree with Bill Cooper, William Cooper. William Cooper claims that back in the 1960s, we had a secret space program. It's kind of one of these alternative three things. And that, you know, everything we've seen has been manufactured. My answer is that if Bill Cooper was right, Viking would never have been allowed to photograph Cydonia and the face on Mars, and we wouldn't have gotten any pictures of anything in the solar system that we could look at and call real at all. So what we're looking at is a learning curve. They've learned in hindsight, not in foresight, as to what to hide. That being the case, in fact, if I'm really clever here, I can show you, you know, a picture is worth 10,000 of those other things, remember? No, I don't have them. I'll have to tell you in words. We have the orbital Viking shots from directly overhead, which were scaled. I mean, we know the scale of those shots. We can see the twin peaks in those pictures. In fact, there's this beautiful map I've got on the web with the sight lines in the north and the east and dimensions, and the scaling of the orbital shots and the scaling of the surface shots matches. You can actually see features from orbit that we're seeing in the Pathfinder images, including the orientation and the corners of these pyramids. So the scale that we're seeing is, in fact, the scale of the things that are there. So the artifacts we're looking at in the near field are small, relatively speaking. The artifacts in the far field, the massive pyramids, are huge. And we must account for this disparity. Now, one possibility is that the guys stayed indoors and did their wars by remote piloted vehicles. That I don't really believe. What I believe is that we're seeing a sequence of evolution, an ancient culture and a more modern culture, and a devolution of size and scale and consciousness. Remember, you get wars when people are not conscious. So the unseen metaphysics of this maps perfectly on the model. I mean, can you imagine what would happen if tomorrow the moon were to blow up and we were left without a moon? In the physics, the model predicts that life on Earth would take a radical downward turn. It would also get incredibly competitive, much more ferocious than it is now. We would see 15 zillion Hitlers arising and Saddam Husseins and all that. We're seeing on Mars the kind of cultural devolution which such a catastrophe of planetary, if not solar system proportions, in fact, predicts. And it's a stunning model which in the months to come, I'm hoping we can put more, data to and documentation. Let's see. What I want to do now is I want to turn our attention to two things. We've got 20 minutes, and I want to read from Nick's paper, because I think it's very important, and I want to put up an appropriate image, and I'm trying to think what image I should put up. I need to tell you a little bit about how this came about, all right? For several years now, I have known that there was something very, very strange in the background of JPL, all right? And that strangeness is an individual named Aleister Crowley. What is not generally known is that Aleister Crowley was very closely connected with the engineer and genius founder of what would eventually become known as the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So let me read, and I have never read one of these things, a paper that Nick and I are going to put on the web in the next few days called JPL Parsons and the Crowley Connection. This subject is very, very esoteric. Not that the rest of the evening has been run-of-the-mill. It deals with the history of our own government and some of the very institutions responsible for sending robots out now between the planets, institutions rich in traditions and even outright symbolism. But of what nature? On what used to be a desolate spot in the Arroyo Seco, north of Pasadena, lies a 165-acre complex called JPL, or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And give me a pause here. And in fact, I can show you a picture. Jack Parsons, a brilliant young Caltech chemist and founder of JPL, forever changed the course of rocketry by adding, with a brilliant flash of insight, the chemical potassium perchlorate to the then standard black powder solid rocket ignition systems being employed at the time, in the mid-1930s. His long-range hope was similar to another rocket pioneer, Robert Goddard's, in this same period.
He wished to develop a more powerful means of eventually exploring space beyond our planet. But official government funding of such impractical dreams in the 30s was essentially non-existent. With the advent of the Second World War, all that changed. Only the sudden infusion of dizzying new funding into this new science was not for scientific exploration. It was for rocketry's more obvious military applications. Through Jack Parsons, JPL thus developed an early institutional expertise in solid rocket propulsion and instrumentation. In parallel in this period to Robert Goddard's individual separate Roswell, New Mexico efforts at liquid fuel experimentation, also carried out in these mid-1930s to 1940s. But in 1957, after the shock of the first Soviet satellite named Sputnik, and a highly visible but explosive failure by a U.S. Navy response, JPL was ultimately chosen by the Army to attempt to salvage American national pride through the launch of a JPL artificial satellite. The successful orbiting of JPL's Explorer 1, whose primary discovery would be the existence of the so-called Van Allen radiation belts encircling the planet, marked the beginning of the American space age, January 31, 1958. It also marked the ascendancy of JPL as the nation's most visible premier space center. As stated, originally under Army jurisdiction, President Eisenhower, concerned about JPL in the hands of the growing Cold War military-industrial complex, had JPL transferred to the civilian sector under a NASA Caltech contract in 1959, where it was given its eventual mandate, if not virtual monopoly, among NASA's many other centers to explore deep space. JPL, again, just up the street, led the U.S. unmanned missions to the Moon with the Ranger and Surveyor projects in the 1960s, to Mercury, Venus, and Mars with Mariners 2 through 10, to Mars with Vikings 1 and 2, and to Jupiter and Saturn and beyond with the equally historic Voyagers. JPL also conducted tracking and communications through the DSN, the Deep Space Network, for Pioneers 10 and 11, and has recently carried out Galileo projects, which not only reimaged and carried out experiments to study Jupiter's atmosphere, but have sent the spacecraft to re-image Europa, one of Jupiter's so-called Galilean moons, now known to have volcanic activity, oceans, and enough internal heat to have possibly spawned life forms that, if they exist, should have evolved and remained undisturbed for 5 billion years. And many of you know that I wrote about that about 20 years ago, which NASA is very conveniently forgetting. As also stated earlier, John Whitesides Parsons, chemist and rocket engineer extraordinaire, was the actual creator of the Caltech lab eventually called JPL, or, among insiders, Jack Parsons Lab. And while there is very little official biographical information to be found on him in the general literature, it is a curious fact that most of his papers and books are still classified by the Department of Defense. One thing that is known, at least within the planetary science community, is that Parsons has been officially immortalized by the International Astronomical Union by having a crater named for him on the moon. It is therefore extremely puzzling that the rest of Parsons' life, in comparison to far more obscure space scientists and engineers, is relatively unknown, even among avid JPL enthusiasts. Perhaps the reason for this paucity of information has something, perhaps a lot, to do with certain aspects of Parsons' private life that most at NASA and JPL, actually in the know, might rather be forgotten. Because one striking aspect of Parsons' private life that has been well documented outside of official governmental sources and publications is his curious association with an individual known as Aleister Crowley. Given Crowley's overwhelming and intensely controversial interests, The demonstrable importance of Crowley in Jack Parsons' private and professional life, stay tuned, and an inexplicable Crowleyan pattern that has recently emerged in all JPL missions, one feels compelled to ask at this late date, who was Aleister Crowley? And what was his heretofore unseen but apparently highly influential role in the founding and evolution of this critical national space facility called JPL? Aleister Crowley was the premier self-styled Western magician of the 20th century, who some have called the most evil man in the world. Crowley simply termed himself the Great Beast. You wouldn't invite him to dinner. Whose secret name in his order was Phoenix, for reasons that will later become apparent. Parsons became one of Crowley's greatest students and was said to have been his personally chosen successor. I mean, let me repeat that. We have documentation, no question, that Parsons was selected by Crowley to be his successor in these arcane magical rituals and ceremonies and practices. This is not something you're going to get from a NASA press release, all right? Parsons quickly moved up the ranks of Crowley's organization called the Order of the Eastern Temple and was eventually appointed head of the lodge in Pasadena by Crowley himself. Parsons swore an oath of allegiance to guide humanity into, quote, an age of communion with the gods. Is this something you're going to read in NASA's official stuff? Using his demonstrable vast talents of insight and science and, in his own words, magic. The objectives of those like Crowley who practice Western magic is ostensibly, quote, to advance humanity by contact with higher intelligence. That is, read, with extraterrestrials. Gosh, is that what they're up to? Either by calling them down or traveling to their planets, which if the objects on STS-48 and STS-80 are what they now appear to be, we almost certainly can. These are things you've seen on the UN briefing and you're going to see before Christmas on our analysis of the shuttle video that was downlinked live by NASA in December of last year. According to Crowley, one can contact these higher intelligences by becoming one with them. That is, by metamorphing into man-gods, or supermen. This was Crowley's primary goal, attainable in his beliefs to the ancient systems of the Hebrew and Greek Kabbalah and other forms of metaphysical, quote, science. All practitioners of magic, philosophically based occultists such as the Theosophists or Freemasons, have been consumed with interest of finding the origins of the human race. You just have to read what they write. It is claimed by the founders of many of these secret orders that they have received guidance from direct contact with those who call themselves the secret chiefs of the Great White Brotherhood. These masters, we are told, have literally dictated the laws and agendas of these mystery schools of ancient thought and wisdom. Now, Crowley, in the latter part of the last century and the beginning of this, the 20th, claimed to have had many such indescribable contacts, but two were of the greatest importance in apparently redirecting his entire life and thus changing the face of modern magic for all who followed. And as astonishing as it may seem, it may be that almost a century ago, Crowley was given a revelation about things that are coming to pass, even as we speak here tonight. The first contact that Crowley relates was in April of 1904 in Cairo. Cairo, by the way, is Seleucid Arabic for Mars. Crowley tells us that he encountered an entity who he considered to be his, quote, holy guardian angel. This entity identified himself as Iwas and proceeded to dictate to Crowley the so-called Book of the Law, or what would eventually become, to some, the canon of 20th century magical practice. In this book, Iwas decrees that, quote, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And then he goes on to say, and I am a god of war and vengeance. I want to get something up here. I am a god of war and vengeance. Choose ye an island and fortify it. Dung it about with enginery of war. I will give you a war engine. And with it you shall smite the people, and none shall stand before you. I am the warrior lord of the 40s. Remember, this was channeled by Crowley in 1904. The last statement is astonishing and quite prophetic, considering it was dictated 40 years before World War II and 93 years before the revelations you've seen this evening, 93 being the number of the book of the law. But more about that significance later. Iwas also gave Crowley a code, a cipher, which is being used by some ufologists in their continuing efforts to decode some UFO contactee experiences. And I have no experience whatever with the use of that, so it's merely part of the record. Here's where things get very curious. Parsons' wife and magical partner, Marjorie Cameron, stated in 1953, in a book written by the successor to Crowley after Parsons kind of blew up, as we will discuss in a moment, stated in 53 that she believed that the war engine referred to by Iwas was none other than the flying saucer, that it would one day bring her back home to Mars, which she believed was somehow her birthplace, thus escaping a future perilous event destined for Earth. This, of course, speaks to the Phoenix theme, so prevalent in Crowleyan lore. This perilous event, according to Crowley, was to usher in the secret eon, or secret ion, depending upon how you spell it, thought to be embedded in humanity, which could be prematurely, before the actual predicted date, made manifest for the initiated through ritual sex magic. Now, one of the curious things that David Oates, when we did the presentation up in Pasadena, withheld until I kind of forced him to put it on the table, was that a lot of the backwards reverse speeches of the NASA JPL Pathfinder team have to do with sex with the rocks. It's on the tapes. We are told that Tibet is where these masters of the Great White Brotherhood, also called the Himalayan Brotherhood, originate. In this mythology, the Aryan race itself is also believed to have come from the mountains of Tibet, lying at 33 degrees north latitude. Strange but true, Roswell, the UFO crash in 1947, Mount Palomar, the largest post-war observatory, Rancho Santa Fe, Heaven's Gate, White Sands, the first A-bomb test, Nagasaki, Japan, the second A-bomb dropped, and Baghdad, Iraq, highlight, of course, of the Gulf War, and Phoenix, Arizona, the Phoenix Lights moving across the city at 19.5 degrees, and Dallas, site of the Kennedy assassination, are all at 33 degrees. Incidentally, Santiago, Chile, which lies at 33 south, where the anomalous NASA UFOs on the STS-80 video were initially filmed, is also apparently an interesting part of this pattern, which we'll lay out in more detail when we produce the video. The word Aryan, incidentally, comes from the word Aries, which is the first sign of the Western astrological zodiac, ruled, of course, by Mars. There are many legends concerning Tibet that speak of a race of supermen inhabiting this region on Earth, a legend which many German intelligentsia and pre-World War II occult societies, like the Thule Society, which Hitler was a member of, adhered to. Unbeknownst to most of the world today, the founders of the Nazi Party, starting with Hitler himself, were steeped in these occult traditions and were profoundly influenced by the teachings of the secret Thule Society, whose demonstrably racist ideologies were a warped version of theosophy and ancient German mythology. By the time of Hitler's rise, most of pre-World War II European occult traditions were dominated by the magical system that Crowley painstakingly created. And Hitler himself was envious of Crowley's infamy as the most evil man in the world, as well as his magical prowess. Hitler said this in several volumes, including one called Hitler Speaks. Crowley claims that his second otherworldly encounter, which resulted in an even more profound influence on his work in magic, occurred at Montauk, Long Island in New York in 1918. This entity introduced himself as Lamb, which Crowley was quick to point out meant path maker, path finder, in the Tibetan language. It is from this word that Lam Az of Tibet are so called. The lamb was also the ancient symbol for Aries, Mars, as well as the resurrected god, Tammuz, Osiris, Christ, etc. Rising from the ashes, Crowley drew an effigy of Lamb, which eerily represents the popular modern image of an alien some half a century later. And somewhere I have an image and I can't call it up because it's not on here. It's in hard copy and we don't have a way to show those. Lamb told Crowley a story about Mars. All right? I need to change something here. That should do. All right? Lamb told Crowley a story about Mars, the fifth sephirot in the Hebrew tree of life, by the way, concerning a lotus flower, a three-petaled pathfinder lander, perchance, symbolic of hyperdimensional physics, looking at a mountain peak which had sharp edges where something sits and shines like the sun on water. He said it was a seed waiting to be born. This story is also related in the earlier book of the law as dictated by Iwas, where it is written that, quote, there will be a reward of Ra Hur Kuit, an aspect of Horus, the babe in the egg, waiting to be reborn, whose number is 97. What year is this? Now, someone asked me before, and I'll need you to speak up. They came up to me and said, do you remember the reverse speech part of David's analysis of the press conferences where they're talking about looking for something? Remember that? Are you still here?
Right here.
Right here. What, do you remember exactly what the words were?
I remember it was a female voice, and I remember she said she referred to one of the Twin Peaks, and she said, there's our prize.
There's our prize. Okay. Lamb then goes on to state, thou art to go this way, and speaks of a lightning flash of enlightenment, which in occult tradition is symbolic of Mars, the god of war and fire. Now, I've been doing a lot of reading, unfortunately, about Hitler in the last month. Not something I really want to do, but I've been kind of compelled to do this because of where part of this, unfortunately, or fortunately, because the truth shall set you free, seems to be going. Hitler used these identical themes during the Blitzkrieg or lightning attacks on neighboring countries, where his officers, who wore lightning bolts on their lapels, were the notorious SS, the original Men in Black. By the way, the previous chapter to the one that Lamb is said to have dictated is in fact called The Tank. Right? And this tank, which was given to Hitler's armored divisions in 1932 by a German general who had French ancestry and was part of another analog of the Thule Society, a secret society out of France, is eerily similar to, in fact, what we're seeing on the Martian surface. The only difference is scale. The previous chapter to the one Lamb is said to have dictated is called The Tank or The Engine of War, samples of which the Enterprise mission has now apparently discovered in the JPL Pathfinder images. The power behind these occult systems of philosophy on which the various mystery schools have historically been based lies in the beliefs of their practitioners that they embody universal laws of nature, reflecting fundamental properties embedded in everything visible
to human beings, including man himself. No one person, people, or race can thus lay just claim to own such laws, although many throughout history, such as Hitler, have made the attempt. Two exquisite but radically different examples of the encoding of such natural systems here on earth are demonstrated by the Hebrew alphabet and by none other than the Great Pyramid of Giza, Egypt. So let me do this. The designers of these two similar but separately unique creations, in fact, apparently have encoded the same internal systems within each, an unfolding mathematical or architectural pattern communicating information proposed by their designers to be streaming from higher dimensions, i.e. a hyperdimensional physics, into our familiar three-dimensional reality. Radically different schematic blueprints represented by widely divergent physical systems here on Earth for, in essence, preserving identical yet extremely ancient views of the origin and structure of the universe. Two examples. The builders of the Great Pyramid, whomever they ultimately turn out to be, not only demonstrably concretized the spatial dimensions of our Earth within its architecture, they built that architecture out of limestone, technically calcium carbonate. This ubiquitous mineral here on Earth, found as both soft chalk and forever-lasting marble, reinforces for us the idea of the creation of life itself, since mountains made of limestone rocks, in whatever form, are called properly the ash of life, as they are literally the remains of once bony structures of millions of endo and exoskeletons of former living creatures on this planet. Thus, in their very form and substance, the pyramids at Giza are literally architectural monuments to the physics of life on Earth. That angle, that 51 degrees everybody talks about, that's part of the hyperdimensional model, exquisitely, as well as the tetrahedral model, and we're not going to get any further into it tonight. There are similar pyramids long known to exist at a variety of other locations here on Earth, and now, through the work of Enterprise and other independent research groups, also on other planets of this solar system, such as Mars. All, according to our preliminary analyses, seem to have been created, at least in part, to reinforce these elegantly simple but profound relationships of living things to universal laws on whatever planet life might find itself. Now, according to the separate but equally important work of our own colleague Stan Tenen at the Meru Foundation in New England, the Hebrew alphabet also encodes these identical, simple, but profoundly universal laws. The revolving shadow pattern of the same mathematical spin, which mimics life unfolding from hyperdimensions into our own. This mathematical spiral form, from a simple topological shape called a two-torus, which looks kind of like a stubby donut or a bagel, is suspended in another simple form, a four-sided tetrahedron. It is the rotation of this tetrahedral form inside a sphere that in Tenen's profound 25-year-old discovery makes the Hebrew letter forms, when the tetrahedron and the ribbon shape inside it are viewed from different angles. Of course, the vertices of the tetrahedron itself rotated inside that sphere, any sphere, touch at 19.47 degrees, rounded off to, of course, that ubiquitous 19.5. Intriguingly, Crowley himself died in 1947. Now, the 19.5 degrees latitude is precisely where the Pathfinder lander and rover have been landed by JPL on Mars, an overwhelmingly important symbolic site, apparently according to NASA press releases, chosen by Matthew Gollumbeck himself, the official Pathfinder project scientist at JPL, whose name, incidentally, in Polish means pigeon, which may mean by extension to go home, as in homing pigeon. The other root, golem, in Hebrew means a perfect copy, as in clone. Now, just recently in Scotland, the bastion of another occult mystery school, the Scottish Rite Freemasonry, in a laboratory not far from Roslyn Chapel,
a renowned monument for Masons, a unique lamb was born, now grown into a sheep, named Dolly. The Dolly Lamb of? Dolly was cloned, and what is more disturbing, according to some press reports, secretly carries human genomes. There were actually 5 siblings of Dolly. 5 lambs are said to have been born around the propitious time of several additional arcane resurrection themes recently, which when coupled with the number 5 itself and the geometry of the pentagon was viewed by many occultists as being of great significance for this historical time period, being highly symbolic of man, the orbit of Earth, its relation to the sun, and, of course, Mars. Now, the year that Crowley died, 47, was also the year of the famous Roswell incident at 33 degrees north latitude, which in Freemasonry is symbolized by the phoenix. The phoenix, of course, is an Egyptian-derived symbolic reference to rebirth or reincarnation. It is fascinating that in hyperdimensional physics, the number 33 refers to the Bucky Fuller tetrahelix model for DNA. In other words, 33 can be viewed as a code number for the fundamental mechanism, it's 33 turns in a certain length, of the fundamental mechanism of biological rebirth, a fitting symbolic foundation for key secret society traditions. In the 1940s, before Crowley's death, Parsons met up with another well-known character in Los Angeles, L. Ron Hubbard. I mean, he had a lot of interesting friends, didn't he? The infamous founder of the Church of Scientology. Parsons and Hubbard quickly became firm friends. And the two of them then set off on self-proclaimed magical rituals of enormous significance, trying to conjure up spirits and summon the gods alchemically, much to the dismay of Crowley, who was suspicious not only of their motives, but their methodology. Remember, he liked talking to the guys directly. Some of these ritual practices were sexual in nature and were performed at the pre-construction site of the Great Palomar Observatory, remember, at 33 degrees north, just south of here, at, they believed, to be a great sexual center of the Earth. Palomar was founded and managed by Caltech, which was also co-founded by none other than Jack Parsons, and in Spanish, Palomar also means the house to which a pigeon comes home. During the course of Parsons' friendship with Hubbard, Parsons naively imparted a vast amount of Crowleyan knowledge to Hubbard. Then Hubbard went on to steal Parsons' wife, Marjorie Cameron, and also his money through a phony business venture. Hubbard later claimed to be the successor to Crowley, the rightful successor, the great beast, but then also claimed at the same time to be working for naval intelligence in order, quote, to spy on these dangerous magicians within our very institutions. Gosh, I wonder what he could be talking about. It was shortly after this experience that Parsons grew darker in his methods and motives and started the now infamous Babylon Working to literally create a child. Babylon actually means the gateway to the gods, which of course you know. The great whore of Babylon, which in Parsons' mind was to have balanced the aspects of our consciousness through sex, magic, and alchemy, was his intent. Crowley, at this point, then threw Parsons out of the order. In one of Parsons' rituals, he was revealed a sign. Now, this is from Kenneth Grant's book on what Parsons was doing in those so-called years when he was the favored son, ceremonially speaking, of Crowley. He, as part of this working, went into trances and saw things. At the time he received Liber 49, Parsons could not have been aware of certain letters written by Frater Achid, and there's a footnote, which came to light after Parsons' death. In them, Achid expressed doubt as to Crowley's having uttered the word of the Aeon of Horus because, having identified himself with the beast, he was speechless. And in some inexplicable manner, not yet clearly understood, the Aeon of Horus itself has become merged with the wordless Aeon. In the Book of Antichrist, Parsons wrote, describing the Black Pilgrimage, which he ostensibly took in this working, quote, Babylon called on me again.
And I began the last work, the work of the wand. And I worked for 17 days until Babylon called me in a dream in an astral working. Then I reconstructed the temple and began the black pilgrimage as she instructed. And I went into the sunset with her sign and into the night past accursed and desolate places and cyclopean ruins. These are huge structures. And so came at last to the city of Chorazin. And there a great tower of black basalt was raised that was part of a castle whose further battlements reeled over the gulf of stars. And upon the tower was this sign, which of course is the sign of hyperdimensional physics, and the exact place on Mars where Crowley's successors at JPL have put Pathfinder down. The sign of none other than the tetrahedron in a sphere, the most representative symbol of the entire hyperdimensional physics model, which is replicated in many forms in the layout of the Martian complex at Cydonia, as well as on our own lunar surface in the lunar crater Oukert, which is, of course, how we found the lunar ruins. Parsons, remember, those were his words. That was his vision. He was shown something, and it has now ruled the space program. Parsons, the founder of JPL, persisted, and it was during one of these great experiments that he mysteriously died in a great explosion. No one then or now has been allowed to identify his body, and the records of his death and his practice are still classified by the U.S. Department of Defense. However, you may read many of his manuscripts from which much of this information has been drawn, which were written and published privately under the auspices of the various OTO lodges scattered around the world. You will not, however, find this crucial missing history of JPL in any official NASA press release or in documentation of existing planetary missions. From the pen of both Crowley and Parsons before they died, their ultimate goal was stated as nothing less than immortality itself, to continue their practice beyond this earth, ultimately extending into the great temple of space itself, in order to once and for all make communion with the gods a reality for them and all mankind. Unfortunately, judging by the astonishing evidence now being leaked from Pathfinder, that ultimate magical reality seems to have survived their passing to be alive and well inside the current NASA, only now reserved for initiates and members of the club. While we, the guys who were paying for the practice with multi-million dollar missions to the planets, have to extrapolate from metaphor, symbolism, deep allegory, and of course from Scooby-Doo and Yogi. Now that you have glimpsed part of the apparent reason for the systematic hiding of the real solar system NASA and JPL have systematically explored and discovered over across more than 30 years, the little-known occult history of JPL and its founder, Jake Whiteside Parsons, it is equally essential that you grasp the hard, reproducible physical evidence on which the current claim is made that Crowleyan magic is indeed alive and well inside JPL and possibly the rest of NASA. And I'm going to show you this, if I can find where I put it, right? It's one of those things. Based on our decoding of this occult JPL tradition, Enterprise, over the last year, has apparently discovered a well-hidden pattern by which NASA has apparently been operating without knowledge of most of its non-initiated scientists or engineers for more than 30 years. This mission pattern, in turn, seems based on demonstrable Egyptian foundations in the Crowleyan occult. According to extensive computer analysis carried out and published by Enterprise over the last year on our website, throughout all of NASA's manned and unmanned space endeavors,
All important milestones in space seem to have been driven by one primary mission function: to launch toward and or to land on, for instance, on Mars in 1976 or on the Moon in 1969 when Sirius, the dog star, Isis, or her consort, Osiris, was positioned at 19.5 degrees or 33 degrees above or below the planetary horizon. This is the time of landing, 33 minutes after Neil and Buzz set the lunar module at Tranquility Base on the Moon. Sirius was exactly at 19.5, at which point Buzz Aldrin broke out a chalice and a wafer and conducted a religious ceremony in the lunar module on the Moon, I strongly suspect, to Isis. He carried with him free Masonic emblems and ancillary material, which he then brought back and gave in a quiet ceremony, of which we have photographs, to the Freemasonic Temple in Washington, D.C., just a couple of blocks up from the White House. Isn't this interesting? And you thought we went to the Moon because of the Russians. Gosh. This extraordinary celestial pattern has continued to the current Mars missions, Mars Pathfinder, which left Earth when Mars was 19.5 degrees above the Atlantic Ocean on December 4th and arrived on Mars on July 4th. And on the 20th, which of course is the anniversary date, they carried out another ceremony, which we'll show in a minute, on this important date, which also is the birth date of Osiris, Tammuz, etc., etc. By the way, Mars Global Surveyor, wonder how that fits in? Remember the solar panel that won't lock into position? Anybody want to guess what the angle is from the normal of the solar panel? 19.5 degrees. Sirius bears an overwhelmingly important place in all occult traditions. Crowley created the Astrum Argentium, or the Order of the Silver Star, for advanced magicians of the Great White Brotherhood in worship of the star Sirius, a place from where the gods may hail. Boy, have we got some new information on that, but that's not the time tonight. Now, unbeknownst to many ordinary citizens and taxpayers who have supported the space program, selection of the landing sites of many of the manned and unmanned lunar missions was manipulated and directed by an Egyptian named Farouk Elbaz. Many other aspects of the flight plans directed by Elbaz, such as launches from the Moon, were also executed in accordance with this ancient Egyptian Masonic celestial mythology, as also memorialized in Crowleyan tradition. It is a little known fact that our government and many of its most revered secular public institutions were all initially based on this system of ancient and natural knowledge, as derived by our free Masonic forefathers, quote, who brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. I want to really stress that. I am not against, quote, secret societies. I'm against the secrecy. The societies themselves have performed incredible, important roles in preserving this information for now, the time when all must employ it for our very future and destiny on planet Earth. The problem is, apparently these days, some men are created a little more equal than others. Today we call these ancient systems the occult, which is rich in information for the chosen few, while we, the unchosen many are given a status quo perspective. Remember, we're still flying 747s 30 years after they were born. This knowledge, of course, truly is power. If it is not just ritual, if this is significant because it is the symbolic language of the physics behind it, i.e. the same hyperdimensional codes and processes we have now discerned all over the solar system and will describe in loving detail in the new book, then everyone has to take part and participate. By any other name, this is hyperdimensional physics. And it was my dear friend Arthur Clarke who many, many, many years ago coined the term that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Now, cultures who have preserved this knowledge and have made it accessible to its populace unfortunately seem to fall victim to a very peculiar pattern. It's called genocide. Witness the Jews at the hands of Hitler. Remember Tenen's work on the Hebrew alphabet. If that's an encoding of this physics, it gives a whole new perspective on what the final solution was all about. Because the Hebrew culture is the carrier wave of this information. Destroy the culture, you destroy the information. At least I am beginning to strongly suspect that that was the strange, bizarre logic behind the inexplicable. And I'm talking, of course, about the Holocaust. The Tibetans, at the hands of the Chinese, have apparently suffered a very similar fate. One aspect of war on Earth may well be the battle to become heir to all aspects of this ancient, crucial knowledge of reality and keep the other guy from finding out. Those in power, apparently on rediscovering this ancient knowledge preserved from when and where, repeatedly make apparent conscious decisions to keep it for themselves. They repeatedly set up institutions recognized as priesthoods, Sumer, Babylon, Egypt, in order to dole out crumbs from this priceless storehouse to all the rest of us, while they do their level best to keep the real secret doctrines totally away. And the reasons are not always selfish, at least it doesn't seem to always start out that way. Usually it comes about because one of those with this special information cannot always freely share what one knows because of the real threat of being persecuted during one of those myriad inquisitions that roll over the planet from time to time to time. However, even when it becomes safe to reveal such knowledge without fear of persecution, as when democracies eventually arise, the withholding of such knowledge by a chosen few seems to become the prime objective for reasons based on arrogance, patriarchy, and discrimination by the chosen. There is also a belief within the mystery schools themselves that true understanding and evolution can only come about through proper cultivation, an innate revelation brought about by symbolism and a consistent array of subtle images and themes. This process is supposed to enable the individual to reveal the bigger picture from within. It appears that this methodology for revealing long secret information is currently taking place at many levels in society, imperiled by those with the foregoing view. Thus, simultaneous with the controllers, there may also exist a few benevolent efforts, truly benevolent efforts, to leak images and paint pictures in a way that those with eyes will see. Is this possibly why we're getting this incredible information about Mars out of JPL, even as they lie at all these press conferences? I mean, I would like to think so. I would really like to think that there is a counterforce, you know, that we've got allies up there, and whatever their long-term agenda, their short-term agenda appears to be to give us the tools to fight back, to face lies with truth. While one of the authors of this paper, myself, has long known of the curious history of JPL, the other, my colleague Nick Skoros, only began serious research for this paper a few months ago. An earlier version was presented in Pasadena the night of 11 September when Mars Surveyor was placed in orbit. Since that time, we have been virtually inundated with Tibetan, Buddhist, Aryan, and Nazi themes in everything from Hollywood blockbusters to television documentaries. 7 years in Tibet is the story of a Nazi SS officer who only recently was revealed, who climbs a mountain in the Himalayas, which the Nazis call our mountain, and later befriends and tutors none other than the Dalai Lama. Even as its premiere is echoing throughout the media, including the cover of Time, a national public radio broadcast addressing the occult Aryanism of Carl Jung was aired in prime time. Even the History Channel's seemingly relentless reliving of the Holocaust and Hitler's henchmen could not escape a recent exclusive on, quote, the occult agenda of the Nazis, to name but some examples. Is someone trying to tell us something? It is our opinion that we need to engage in immediate conversation with the current keepers of this ancient knowledge based on our own developing, quickening, awareness that someone deems it of sufficient importance to have built an entire 30-year space agenda secretly around it. It is overdue for the rest of us, the non-initiated, to reclaim our heritage as well. According to some, nothing less than the knowledge of reality and destiny itself. The Mars rover, which landed on July 4th of this year, landed at 19.5 at Ares Valley, the valley of the god of war, called Ares. Interesting. It would seem that Crowleyan prophecy from Iwas. Now, I've talked to some magicians, and there are magicians in our midst, and they have a very interesting take now in light of all this on Iwas. They infer from what he said to Crowley and what was written, particularly the chapter 3, the third book, where the overwhelming war images of Mars are just amazing, that Iwas is really I was, meaning it's a transcendental conveyance of information that this is us. Somehow we are connected. And that's part of the suppression. We're not supposed to know that, because maybe we can change something if we know. Anyway, it would seem that Crowleyan prophecy is indeed being fulfilled today on Mars by the great inheritors, whoever they are, of the Word of God at JPL. It's time the rest of us joined in this crucial conversation. To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, which I do not often do, after all, we are paying for this microphone. Thank you. Before I end with a bang and not a whimper, and we will have about half an hour for questions, I have been obviously conveyed a note. No secrets here. This is from the anonymous author of the piece in Atlantis Rising by the military affairs analyst I spoke of before, who apparently is here tonight, who wants you to know that the upcoming piece on the September 11th conference when is it going to come out?
A couple of weeks.
Oh, it's that soon.
Yeah,
okay.
It's the next issue.
Next issue. Is that the one with also Tenen's material in it?
I don't know.
Because he said November, so I mean that's November.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was told they're past deadline, so it's the next issue. It should be number 13, interestingly enough.
Really? Okay. And I've misspelled something. Oh, okay.
The rest of that is just for you.
It's just for me? Oh, you mean I can't read it? Good news, bad news. Okay. Anyway. All right. I want to get to the MacGuffin, the ultimate MacGuffin. And then I'm going to end with a piece of film. Can you put in the last tape, the one that was on the bottom, on the Sphinx? I am not very pleased with the direction that this investigation is taking. Because I really have an innate, deep revulsion when I see pictures of human beings treated as they were at Buchenwald and Auschwitz and places like that. And like an awful lot of other people, I thought that was all safely in the past. And I'm at some level of denial, because intellectually I know
that at the end of the war, we literally, as part of official U.S. government policy, brought thousands of Nazis, including some very prominent rocket engineers and scientists. And they were taken into our bosom to literally forge the means to take us to the moon. And it was done through an army operation called Operation Paperclip. Well, remember, JPL was, before it was a civilian NASA contractor, was in fact part and parcel of the Army, of the Ordnance Division. Many of these former Nazis, is that an oxymoron, came literally to California and went to work at JPL. There are overwhelming paper trails now indicating that the philosophy, the occult secret agendas behind much of the Nazi inexplicability, which is never dealt with except suddenly for the first time in this Modern History Channel reprise of the occult origins of Nazism, which is a fascinating insight into something which doesn't make any other sense, were brought home just up the street at JPL. And what appears to have occurred is the beast simply took us over quietly, in part, in major segments of the most important program, the early warning system of humanity itself. Now, how do I know that? It's because of signatures. I have run the data on the various lunar stuff. You know, I'll pop this up again, all right? I've run this by engineer after engineer after engineer formerly involved with the space program. Some people like Marv Zarnik, who worked for many, many years at McDonnell Douglas, who worked with Aldrin, who worked with the rendezvous and orbital equations for not only orbital rendezvous for Gemini, but also on Apollo, on the shuttle. I mean, he's worked on everything. When I showed him these computer results, and he was able to go and check them by getting a copy of Redshift himself and running the numbers and taking the data from NASA's own publications of the times of landing and launching and all that, he was staggered and extremely distraught. Because it was obvious to him that his entire profession had been in service to a lie. This has to have been the most important reason for landing on that Sunday evening on July 20th. None other reason need apply. Because you couldn't get to that piece of real estate when this star was at that angle unless you planned it. And it had to be the number one priority. Now, who was behind the plan? And were there more than one set of masters? And has there been some kind of coup inside NASA? Did it start out as a light work a la the Masonic Founding Fathers tradition? And did it get taken over by the pirates, the neo-Nazis who we brought in, who then staged a palace coup? I don't know. I'm going to find out. With a little help, I'm going to find out. And we're well on our way to finding out. It is non-trivial to find out. Well, let me show you where this has now taken, where this twist, which has so confounded the folks on our website who are in anguish that I would dare to put this stuff on the web without telling them what it means yet. And I don't intend to tell them what it means. I want them to do their own damn homework. It's time people didn't look at a screen and say, somebody ought to do something. It's time we all did something. Because the situation now is very similar to in Germany before World War II. Things are slipping inexorably away from democratic institutions and into a big brotherism, which frankly scares me to death. And I would never imagine in pursuit of things on Mars that it would have any possible practical relevance to my going out here, getting in a car, driving down the street, and being picked up and slammed into jail by some cop who doesn't like the way I look. And if I was black, what are the odds that that would happen after midnight in a nice suburb, et cetera, et cetera? In other words, we're looking at the progressive events that have taken place before, and like you turn the water up on the frog at some point doesn't even know it's boiled to death until it's too late. Let me show you this, all right? We will. We are getting rapidly close to wrapping up, all right?
Was Tebbesnai corrected? Did this have all been put away?
When you say this put away, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, it's past Nazi times. What we're looking at here is all of us are part of the rebel alliance going against the empire.
Okay.
We're infiltrators into the secret society.
You see, the only reason I think this stuff is even alive and well is because it's become so outlandish that no one takes it seriously. The greatest secrecy weapon is not a stamp, top secret, not burned before reading. It's to make it hysterically laughable so nobody pays serious attention. Exactly. There's an absolute parallel here. Now, this is what we have found. On Sol 26, our nice friend somehow inside, leaking the truth, downlinked this image and put it on the web from the lander. All right? This is a structure on the spacecraft next to a round medallion which has no counterpart in the lander in the sandbox. And this is a bronze plaque. I haven't touched this at all. This is just an image put up and contrast enhanced. There is a door, a clamshell door, which splits this in half and opens and closes. And this photograph was taken during that mysterious outage of communication with the lander on July 20th. It is a ceremonial unveiling of a plaque. Now, you may not be able to discern what the plaque looks like. So what I've done is to enlarge the plaque. And on the plaque, there is an observatory, a flying saucer, a la Adamski, which was seen on the grounds of Palomar at 33, the sexual center of Earth, according to Mr. Parsons, who, of course, is the progenitor of this fine laboratory. And there is, inside the open door, a skull, which in my schematic, which I have put side by side for clarity, is eerily proportioned, flange for flange and bone for bone. I have no doubt, none, zero, nada, that this is what is sitting on the lander. Now, there's incredible doubt on the web because people don't want to believe what they're seeing. They don't want to go down that road. And we must go down this road because if we don't, things will continue to happen, which we are not going to like if this is true. Now, let me do the next part, which is this. Something about this triggered a memory. And it didn't take me very long. I mean, what in the world is a skull doing on a plaque on the spacecraft on Mars? When the backward speech, by the way, is commemorating the white man's skull, which of course is what David Oates has found. And then I found this symbol. And on the SS officers, the first men in black, Hitler's and Himmler's chosen black order of magical knights, of practitioners, of guards of the old order, this symbol, in fact, is there. And to me, there is nothing more compelling than the paper trail through Operation Paperclip, the Crowley and Parsons connection to the occult, and sitting on the Martian surface on a spacecraft doing things we know not what, there is a commemorative image that we thought was safely dead and buried. We must not make this mistake once again. Thank you.
You have been listening to Ruins Found on Mars with Richard C. Hoagland. For information on this and other programs from She Who Remembers, call 626-287-8254. Or contact us on the internet at www.remembers.com. This has been a She Who Remembers production.